From PRI, Public Radio International, Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're celebrating the Oscars. Later in the show, we'll rebroadcast conversations with Octavia Spencer, who talks about playing mathematician Dorothy Vaughn in the movie Hidden Figures, and Michael T. Williamson, who reflects on his role in the big screen adaptation of August Wilson's Fences. The film received 4 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. But first, Barry Jenkins wrote and directed the critically acclaimed coming-of-age movie Moonlight. With this film, Jenkins has made Oscar history. He is the first African-American to have a film nominated in all of the major categories, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Picture. He joins me now to talk about the project and its success. But before our conversation begins, here's a clip from Moonlight featuring Naomi Harris.
Sharon! Hey!
Hey, Ma.
Hey, baby. Where'd you go last night?
What? Why?
Well, I'm your mama, ain't I? Why you ain't just come home later, boy? You had me worried about you. I guess you getting grown. I can't be keeping up with you all the time. Anyway, baby, how Teresa doing, huh? Now, I ain't even seen her since the funeral. Listen, Mama locked herself out the door, yeah? Can you come let her in?
I heard you whisper to me when that clip played, this is a tough scene.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I think when you're watching someone as gifted, as talented as Naomi Harris basically embody these memories from your past, embody your mom in this very tough moment. To direct it was tough, and to watch is tough.
You know?
It's very dark.
Yeah. Give me a better sense of where you overlay some of your story in with the story of the author that makes for the film.
Yeah, so both myself and Terrell Alvin McCraney, the playwright who wrote the source material in Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, we both grew up in the neighborhood you see depicted in the film. It's a neighborhood called Liberty City.
You didn't know each other then, though?
Didn't know each other. Yeah, we went to some of the same schools, we realized. We're about 8 months apart in age, and we should have known each other. We certainly feel like both our moms not necessarily knew each other, but they must have been in the same places because they both struggled with this addiction to crack cocaine that you see depicted by Naomi Harris in the film. And so pretty much everywhere, with the exception of, sexuality, myself and Terrell's life just completely overlapped.
Yeah. What do you make of the serendipity of that?
It's one of those things where I'll speak to this. For a long time, I didn't want to tell this story.
Mm-hmm.
I just wasn't comfortable, talking about these things. And it took, randomly, meeting, becoming friends with Terrell, in the 33rd year of our lives, to see that he had gone to this place where he was ready to speak on it, that I could have the courage to speak on it as well. Just amazing the way the world conspires sometimes.
Tell me more then, Barry, about how cathartic or not the experience has been for you to tell the story, not just on screen, but obviously in these conversations, when the subject comes up, you're obviously sharing more about your own personal journey.
Yeah.
Has that been cathartic? Is that the wrong word? What's it been for you?
No, I think cathartic is the right word. I think it's a little more nuanced for me, depending on the frame of the conversation, where I'm having it, who I'm having it with. I think for my mom and I, it's been a very progressive experience. It allowed us to progress in our friendship and our relationship. I think the act of making the movie for me with her was a part of coming to this point where I didn't feel like these things we went through was anything to be ashamed of, and wasn't anything to bury or to hide. On the flip side, there are people from all over the place who hit me up on like Twitter, Instagram, things like that, who've been through the same experiences. And what we all realize is we get to the point where we feel like we can't talk about this with other people because we think either people will shun us, or they'll pity us, and I think in dealing with these things so openly, I must say, it's gotten to the point where it's just a part of my story, like everybody else has a story to tell.
Can I ask, and if I can't, you can, don't slap me, but can I ask?
Barry Jenkins came on the show with Slap Tavis Smiley.
You like that?
Not having it. Not having it.
And then he laughs after he said it. I slapped him.
Not having it.
Anyway, may I ask what the relationship is like these days between you and your mother?
It's good. It's productive. For a long time, we didn't talk about these things. You know, it's funny. I told someone, you know, I don't know that my mom is ready to watch this film. I don't think she wants to see herself reflected in this way. You know, I think it's a very honest depiction. You know, she's read every interview Naomi Harris has given, and she has signed off on Naomi's approach to playing her. And then someone else was like, no. I think what it is she doesn't want to see the other character. She doesn't want to see how this character Little is affected by the things y'all went through. And I was like, oh, I guess, yeah, I can see where you're coming from.
So to your knowledge, at this point, your mother still has not seen it as yet?
Still has not seen it. I think she doesn't want to watch it with an audience, you know? I think she wants to watch it, you know, by herself. So I'm actually sending her a DVD ahead of the DVD release. And, you know, she can pop it in at her leisure.
What do you expect will happen after she sees it?
I think she'll be proud, you know, because everyone else in my family has seen it. You know, everyone's extremely proud, you know. You know, as including my sister, who is, you know, probably the closest person in my family who also went through these things. I think she'll be proud of the work, and I think she'll see, I think Naomi's portrayal is full of tenderness in the appropriate places. But I think it's very honest and raw in other places, you know. And I'm still here, bro. You know, I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, that is important. Well, you couldn't have done it if you weren't, so I'm glad you are. So I'm not saying this because you're here. I'm saying it because it's true, and I'm saying it because I want to get to something here. So I'm fortunate to talk to a lot of people on this program. And I travel around the country. I'm always in conversations with all kinds of people in airports and hotels and so on and so on, and restaurants. I have not gone anywhere and had a conversation with anybody, never mind race, color, gender, sexual orientation. I've not gone anywhere and had a conversation with anybody who saw this film and didn't love it. I mean, every single person who I have talked to who has seen this film, including half of my crew here, loved the film. And they love it in part because no matter who they are, no matter what, you know, they are made of, there's something universal about this story that everybody connects to. And that's what I think a great film is. It allows all of us to wrestle with and revel in our own humanity and that of other people. But I'm curious, having said all that, how you take a film that is this specific about an experience that most Americans do not have, particularly those who've seen this film, and yet they connect to it. What is, how did you pull that off?
You know, the one thing I'll say is because we weren't trying to pull that off. I think we sort of tried to lean in and, as you say, make the most specific film we could.
Try but to Black really Folk in the Project is not a universal story.
It's not, but it is, you know. It is in the sense that I think we can all identify with, no matter where you are, you know, whether you're in the projects in Miami or, you know, you're growing up, you know, with a silver spoon in your mouth in Rotterdam, which is where I just came from. I think we can all identify with this aspect that, you know, we move in the world, and the world is giving us all this response, you know, and it's, the world is telling us, that thing you did, that was cool. This other thing you did, not so cool. And we receive that and we go, oh, I'm not going to do this thing anymore, even though I feel it's the right thing, even though I feel it's who I actually am. I think everybody can identify, you know, with this sort of struggle, you know, to decide for yourself, you know, who you are, you know, and what your place in life is. And I think because we tell that struggle, but we don't try to codify it any other way than having fidelity to the world it's set in, the place it's set in, and the things myself and the playwright went through, I think people respect that, you know? And I think they respect us for inviting them in, you know? Because I do think the film is not told in a way that's meant to manipulate an audience into identifying with it, but it is an inviting experience, you know? We literally invite the audience to walk a mile in our character's shoes and then to be in the body of the characters. I think people, they relish that, you know, and they appreciate it.
I've also heard from countless people, and these are not cinematographers who belong to the union, but just people who go to see film, who just in their own way are trying to, have tried to share with me how much they love the way the film was shot. What trick would you do to pull us in regarding the way you shot this thing?
You know, the biggest trick I would say is, you know, if I tell you I'm making a movie about a poor black boy growing up in the hood with a mom addicted to drugs, struggling with his sexuality, you think you know what that film looks like, you know? It's a very drab, social realist documentary kind of film. We wanted this movie to be rooted in the consciousness of our main character. You know, Chiron has a huge interior life, even though he's not expressing himself verbally as much as the other characters around him. And so there's certain moments where the character's disoriented, like with the scene with Naomi Harris in the courtyard. And we wanted to allow ourselves the freedom to then go to slow motion, look our character right in the eye. There's so many places where there are things that defy the expectations of the setup of a scene. It's because we're in the interior mind of the character. You know, I think another aspect of it is, you know, film as a medium, you know, has only been around for 120 years. It hasn't changed much. Mm-hmm. Film emotion was calibrated to photograph white skin. You know, those are the people who could afford to buy the Kodak Instamatic cameras on the mm-hmm. weekends. And so, you know, we have all these lights in this room. We often put powder on people. Mm-hmm. You know, in this film, where I grew up, I remember black folks sweating. You know, I remember the skin replenishing mm-hmm. itself, being very moist. I mean, that's alive. So in this film, the makeup person was told, no powder, only oil. Mm-hmm. We got grapeseed oil, jojoba oil, shea butter, all this kind of stuff to allow the skin to reflect the light, the light. And so I think our visual approach, because it's coming from my memory of what it felt like to live this experience, and also we're allowing ourselves to be rooted in the consciousness of the character, it just arrives, I guess, fresh and different. And I think people, when they see these images, when they receive them, they feel like they're seeing things for the first time. Mm. Even though they've maybe seen a story like this before, they haven't seen it told in this way. Mm. And the visuals have a lot to do with that.
It must make you feel awfully good to know that not only is the film nominated, the screenplay, adapted screenplay, film for Best Picture, as I said earlier, Best Director for you, but you've got two of your cast members mm-hmm. who've been nominated for the big awards. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the casting. I mean, clearly, in retrospect, it was brilliant casting when Naomi was here. I remember her telling me when she was here, Barry, that you guys shot this thing really quick.
Yeah.
How many days?
25 days.
25 days. Not a big budget?
No, it's like under $2 million.
Under $2 million. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how did you know that these were the right people to cast, not just to play these roles, but to give you what you needed in 25 days? That's mm-hmm. 25 days ain't a lot of time to make a bunch of mistakes.
Yeah, it's true.
If you're gonna do something in 25 days, you had better get the right people because mm-hmm. the scope and the time is so limited. So tell mm-hmm. me more about obviously the brilliance of your casting, given that the Academy has nominated two of your actors. Mm-hmm.
You know, the first part of it was we gave ourselves a lot of time to find the right people. You know, with Naomi and Mahershala, you know, we knew what they could do. We knew they were going to be great. And Naomi in particular is the only actor who appears in all three mm-hmm. chapters of the film. So, you know, everybody else is doing this thing where they walk on for a story and then we recontextualize the character because he's embodied by a different person, you know, in chapter 2 and chapter 3. Naomi has to literally convey that she's become a different person from story to story. So, you know, we knew we needed someone who was very gifted and skilled for her part, and we just took the time to find her. Same thing with Mahershala. Mm-hmm. The other actors, it was about the sort of like presence, this essence. You know, film is not an amazing medium to relay interiority. I think literature is much better for that. And yet in this film, we have a character who's retreating into himself, and so we needed the interior life to be visible on his exterior, mm-hmm. like the expression, the body posture. And so we just gave ourselves, you know, we shot the movie in 25 days, we cast for about 16 months. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, you figure out where you need to put the time, you know, where you need the time, and the time was in casting. And you know, luckily, you know, we just eventually, you know, we started to build it in blocks. You know, we find one actor, then we find another actor, we find a different actor. And eventually, I think we got to this place where we had a group of people who all just had this soulfulness, you know. They believed in the material, they believed in the characters, and they believed in the film. Mm-hmm. And when they showed up, you know, what I like to say is, a person like Mahershala, he's only in one-third of the film, mm-hmm. and yet he gave his full self. Mm. I think everybody in this film gave their full selves. And I got to say about the nominations, thank you for mentioning how widespread they were. Because, mm-hmm. you know, this movie, it took a village. There's no other way to make this film than everybody pitching in. And what I love about our 8 nominations is spread across the whole gamut mm. of the village that made the film. Because you remove any one piece, and not that it falls apart, but it's not the same project.
Yep. So let me ask you to set your modesty aside just for a second here. Mm-hmm. I found myself in the same position, Barry, a couple years ago when mm-hmm. Damien Chazelle broke out. Mm-hmm. And Lord, has he broken out now. Yeah. This young brother is doing the mm-hmm. thing with La La Land this year and all mm-hmm. of that. So Damien's done quite well the last few years since I first met him. But I recall having him in this chair and asking him the very same question I want to ask you now, which is tell me a bit more about your backstory. Because once you come on the scene, everybody knows your film, mm-hmm. everybody's talking about your film, but we don't know you. Who is this Barry Jenkins? We know where you came from, Miami, but tell me more about your journey professionally for how you mm-hmm. got the opportunity or took the opportunity to make this masterpiece.
Yeah, you know, it starts off with film school. You know, I'm a mm-hmm. public school kid. I grew up like the kid in this movie. Right. And, you know, Florida State just happened to be the big public school in the state of Florida where you could go to if you had a certain GPA.
Right.
So I went there on a free tuition scholarship paid for by the Florida Lottery.
Yeah.
And
Yeah. Shout out to the Florida Lottery.
Shout out to the Florida Lottery. And you know, the state of Florida, you know, back then, I think it was run a bit differently. You know, the state of Florida wanted to drive the film industry in the state. So they mm-hmm. built a film school, and they invited Florida kids into that program. It was a beautiful situation, because as someone who grew up poor, they provided the equipment, the stock, all these different things. So I got into film school. I went, didn't know anything about it. Over the course of 2 years, kind of got kind of good at it. You know, I had a brief moment where I wasn't sure if I could do it. You know, I didn't know you needed light to expose film. And, you know, I grew up poor, black, mm-hmm. with a mom addicted to crack. I thought, oh, I'm not good at this because people like me just aren't meant to be good at this. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, over the course of 2 years, I did the work. And I taught myself, you know, how to shoot my own film. You know, instead of watching what I thought was the best in world cinema, I trained myself mm-hmm. on how to do this. Moved out here. I worked at Ms. Winfrey's company, Harpo Films, for 2 years. Assistant to the director named Darnell Martin on a movie called mm-hmm. The Rise of Watching God. 6 years later, I made a very low-budget $13,000 independent film called Medicine for Melancholy, mm-hmm. starring Wyatt Cenac. And it kind of got me put on. You know, I got signed at CAA. Plan B saw that film. I tried to work on a few things. Didn't quite work out. And then 6 years after that first film, I wrote this. And I've worked at this film festival in Telluride called mm-hmm. the Telluride Film Festival.
Sure.
Been there since 2002. I used to make popcorn. I was an usher, clean toilets, everything. Grew up there as a kid. Now, in 2013, by that point, I'm introducing films and programming short films. I write the screenplay, and I come back. I wrote this movie in Brussels, Belgium. I fly from Brussels directly to Telluride. And this is a little movie called Toy is a Slave. Mm-hmm. That's world premiering at Telluride. They come off the stage and go, hey, Barry Jenkins, well, we know who you are. What are you up to? I was like, oh, well, actually, I just adapted this play by Terrell McCraney called The Moonlight Black Boys Look Blue. 3 years later, we premiere Moonlight at the Telluride Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And now we got 8 Academy Award nominations. Yeah. Now, I speed read that, but that's my story.
No. I asked that question, and you didn't have to go that fast, but I'm glad you laid it all out. But I asked that question because it is not just instructive mm-hmm. or informative, but it is empowering and is inspiring to persons who see this program, who mm-hmm. see this, you know, kicked around social media, to understand the backstory. Mm-hmm. And I say all the time, people see your glory, but they don't know the backstory.
True.
And it's important to hear that, because there's some people who are struggling, not just in film, but struggling with whatever it is they want to become. Mm-hmm. And it's important for them to hear a story mm-hmm. of what happens and what the process is mm-hmm. to get you where you need to be. And then you look up and you get the right material, and lo and behold, you got 8 Academy Award nominations.
Yeah, you know, I think for a lot of people, it seems like I kind of just appeared 5 months ago.
And that's never the case.
No, it's never the case. You know, it wasn't the case with Damien. It's certainly not the case with me. You know, I think I have been very fortunate, you mm-hmm. know, in a certain way. Not everybody works at the Telluride Film Festival. Mm-hmm. Not everybody gets to introduce, you know, an Academy Award winning film starring Brad Pitt, you mm-hmm. know, and produced by his company. You know, I was in all those places. But that all started in 2002 with me being a kid who just wanted to work at a film festival, you know? Mm. And then I kept at it, you know? And not that I always had faith that something like this would happen, was mm. happening with Moonlight, mm. but I just love the work, you know? I sometimes teach kids, you know, like film classes, I say, be in love with the process, not the results. Mm. And the process will generate the results, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that's been the case with this film, certainly, and I think with the whole course of my career so far.
Yeah. So you have been around long enough to see the juxtaposition between what didn't happen last year for mm-hmm. black folk at the academies mm-hmm. and what is happening this year mm-hmm. for black folk at the academy. What do you make of the year?
Yeah, you know, I wish we could go back in time and then place these same films into last year, mm-hmm. You know, then I think we'd have some data to compare. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, one, all these films started 3.5, 4, 5 years ago, mm-hmm. 7 years ago in Case of Fences, you know, they just happened to arrive mm-hmm. at this moment, I think beautifully. They've all arrived at this moment. You know, I was in the room with Hidden Figures one mm. at SAG. I mean, it was just like this amazing feeling. And again, we all just happened to arrive at this moment. You know, I think that what happened last year, not that it was necessary, but I think it made people sit up mm. and pay attention. I compare it to the Rooney Rule in mm-hmm. the NFL, you know,
sure.
for the longest time. Why
Absolutely.
Were there no black head coaches? It wasn't about you have to hire a black mm-hmm. head coach. You have to, at the very least, interview
sure,
candidates.
Sure. Absolutely.
I think with the Oscar So White, it's been a situation where, again, if I tell you what my film was about, the synopsis, you might assume, oh, I know that film. Mm. I know what that looks like. You know, I don't need to watch that. Whereas now it's like, you know what? I need to sit up and pay attention. I'm going to watch that film. And lo and behold, it's not what I expected. Mm-hmm. So I think that this year is different because the mandate has been created where it's like, no, you know, we can't get away with looking the other way or overlooking or looking past some of this work. And the beauty of it is, I think the industry I work in is not an homogenous industry. Mm. Everybody nominated this year exist within this industry. I'm glad that we have a group of nominees that are more reflective of not only the industry I work in, but the world I live in, mm-hmm. which, as we all know, is more important today.
Yeah. Speaking of the world we live in, and speaking of the SAG Awards, there were a lot of good speeches, mm-hmm. handful of great speeches, but Mr. Ali's speech, I thought, was just phenomenal.
Yeah.
How were you? I mean, you know him because you directed him in this film. He obviously gave you a huge shout out. But how did you imbibe? How did you intake what he was saying mm-hmm. in that moment? Because I thought it was powerful.
Yeah, it was. You know, Ali is a great man. You know, I call him Ali. Yeah. Mahershala is a great man. And I think in his greatness, he is very modest. You know, yeah. and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't place himself, you know, at the forefront. Of many things, you know, and by necessity, maybe, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I was proud that he stood up, you know, and said what he said. I think, you know, a lot of us are feeling threatened, you know, and I think for Mahershala, he feels more threatened than others for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. you know. It's not a good feeling to feel like your religion, you know, could lead to you being persecuted within the country that you call home, mm-hmm. You know, the country that you love, you know, I would say speaking on behalf sure. of him. And so I thought he was just in saying what he said. I thought it came from the heart. Not that it needed to be said, mm-hmm. But I was damn glad it was said.
Yeah, yeah. So how are you processing all this? I see they're on the ground now.
Yeah, yeah. you know, man. There's a lot going on that is bigger than me. Yeah. You know, I am the kid in this film. You know, Terrell and I are the kid in this film. And mm-hmm. I think you watch this movie and you don't assume a character like Chiron, a kid like him, is going to grow up and win a Golden Globe.
Yeah.
Or be nominated for 8 Academy Awards. And I think people back home see this, what's happening to me, and they take pride in it. They take joy in it. And they see it, you know, as this thing that's possible. You know, it expands the world, you know, of what people like us who are from this place are capable of. And, you know, I think because of that, you know, I have to stay grounded. You know, I think I have to be strong for all these folks that are rooting for us. And then at the same time, man, my job is to carry the voice of this movie as far as I can. You know, I just got back from 2 weeks in Europe, hitting 7 different cities, you know.
Yeah.
And despite the myth that black folks, you know, images don't travel overseas, mm-hmm. this one is traveling damn well overseas. Yeah. And so I think doing that good work absolutely keeps me grounded. And I remember what it was like on those 25 days in that heat in Miami when all these group of people who knew nothing about me, did not have any expectations of Academy Awards, were working their off because they believe in the project. And I think having the pride in that and remembering what that work was like, the process, you know, I think it keeps me a bit buffeted from any of these results, whether they go good or whether they go bad.
Yeah, well, that's a very adult way to handle it.
I'm trying, bro.
I look forward to having you back in the months and years to come.
Thank you, bro.
Proud of you, Barry Jenkins.
Much respect.
Honored
man.
To meet you,
Thank
my
you.
Friend.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Hidden Figures tells the story of three African-American women who were integral to NASA's Friendship 7 mission in 1962. This historic event made John Glenn the first American to orbit the Earth. Octavia Spencer plays one of the mathematicians, Dorothy Vaughn, NASA's first African-American supervisor. Before we get to that conversation, though, here's a clip from the film.
New assignment came down the pike.
Me?
Temporarily, yes. We need the IBM for Glenn's launch. The lead engineer says you're good with the cards, programming, and such.
What about the girls here?
Well, human computers can't calculate an orbital flight in the time we have. They'll stay put for now.
I'm not accepting reassignment unless I bring my ladies with me.
Excuse me?
We're gonna need a lot of manpower to program that beast. I can't do it alone. My gals are ready. They can do the work.
Can I just high-five you on that number one thing?
Thank you. We'll take it.
What do you make of beating out Rogue One?
I think the irony of the fact that this movie took 50 years to make about three women who helped get our astronauts to space and back home safely, and we are battling or were battling a movie about space was quite befitting.
That is kind of funny, isn't it?
It's pretty funny.
When you said a story 50 years ago, it is... Not that I'm supposed to know everything and not that you're supposed to know everything, but it is always humbling for me. In some ways, I just feel stupid and belittled when there's a story of this powerful that I just don't know. And then when I come into the knowledge of it, It is so empowering. It is arresting. How did you take hearing about this story the first time?
Well, I'm equally embarrassed, but I don't take that onus because how do we know about it if it's not presented to us?
True enough.
And, you know, if you're not in those fields, if you're not inclined to know those things, you know, you won't.
Yeah.
For me, I thought it was historical fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, I had just done The Help.
Yeah.
And I was told that I would be meeting with the producer, Donna Gelati, who always picks these wonderful projects with strong roles for women. Mm-hmm. And when I met with her, I thought it was a work of fiction because I had never heard of these women.
Yeah.
And to find out that it was true, to Google it and see, you know, very little about Mary Jackson and mm-hmm. Dorothy Vaughan, but to see that Katherine Johnson had been given the Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama, it was bittersweet, but I also felt compelled at that moment to know that these women went largely unheralded for their contributions to the space race. Yeah. I knew I had to be a part of it.
So how fast did you and how far did you fall in loving Dorothy Vaughan?
I fell in love with Dorothy Vaughan when I got the script. I met on it 2 years ago, uh-huh. January.
Right.
And when I got, it was just a proposal at the time. And then a few months later, I got a script and I fell in love with Dorothy Vaughan.
Yeah.
I mean, to have the mechanical inclinations, to have an engineer's brain wrapped in this quality woman who's a mom, who's a God-fearing woman, who was existing in a time when she was viewed as a second-class citizen, but that didn't bother her. She still did the work and mm-hmm. contributed in such a major way. Who wouldn't want to play her?
Yeah. You obviously are an Academy Award winner. I saw your friend
Viola
Davis win for Fences.
Yes.
And Tracy Ellis Ross wins for her TV show Black-ish. And you have this film that's number one at the box office with three black women as the leads. I don't want to colorize this, but clearly color is a part of it. Race is a part of it. How do you process this moment where these sisters are getting all this love?
You know what? I think with the current political climate, a lot of suppressed views have reemerged. Mm-hmm. And those who don't subscribe to those views are understanding that they have a voice that they have to use to speak out on behalf of all people and to educate their children in a way that will be more inclusionary so that we don't take 50 mm-hmm. A step back 50 years. So I see it as that. But, you know, an Indian young man was on stage with an even smaller Indian mm-hmm. for Lion. I'm really encouraged. Mm. I'm really encouraged by what we're seeing happening.
Yeah. In the canon of the stuff you've already done, how does it feel to have played a real-life black female mathematician?
She's a superhero.
Yeah.
And I've never been offered, you know, one of the superhero shows where you get to wear tights.
Yeah.
But I had to wear tights.
Yeah.
And they were tight.
I must say, not to cut you off, but I must say, that opening scene when you land on the ground under that car, trying to fix that starter. I don't want to get the movie away, but the opening scene is worth the price of the admission. One of the opening scenes, just to see you slide from underneath that car. But I digress. Go ahead. You were saying about wearing tights.
Yeah. Well, she's a superhero to me.
Yeah.
And you know what? We need these images.
Yeah.
Young boys and girls need to know that they possess the inner workings to change the world. You don't need a cape and superpowers. Your brain, it all starts here in how you perceive yourself and your place in the world. And I think I would have dreamed a different type of dream. I'm a creative, but I would have dreamed a different type of dream for myself. But I do believe everything happens for a reason, because we are now meant to propel the story forward for the future generation of young women in STEM.
Yeah. Speaking of kids, you've written some children's books, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell me about the books, your children's books.
Ninja Detectives, Randy Rhoads' Ninja Detectives.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted a multicultural group. Some people were upset that my protagonist was a little white girl, but I knew that I wanted a young black boy, and I wanted to tell the story about a young girl being a leader. Mm-hmm. So I chose the two boys that to be in her little group to be Latin and African American because they don't see themselves in literature. And I wanted to make sure that young black boys saw themselves in literature, my literature.
Yeah. It is always interesting to me to hear an actor come on the show and say, so I read this thing 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, we get a chance to see it, fall in love with it. It becomes number one. But you guys obviously are so ahead of the process. Mm-hmm. That's my way of leading up to asking, so what are you working on now? What are you reading now that we're going to be celebrating you in a couple years from now?
Well, we're doing Madam C.J. Walker.
Ooh,
Casey Lemons is
my hometown of Indianapolis.
She's doing it. Yeah. And I'm excited to be doing that.
Yeah.
We're also doing a movie about Jonestown with Vince Gilligan is writing it and Michelle McLaren is directing it. I'm just choosing projects that are multifaceted and, you know, Madam C.J. Walker's story is one that young...
You're playing her.
I'm playing C.J.
I love you already.
You know, I mean, she was a part of my dream.
Yeah.
So the fact that I get to play her is it's monumental.
There's a wonderful theater in my hometown of Indianapolis that bears her name, the Madam C.J. Walker Theater. And I've spoken on that stage so many times at all kinds of events. The last time I was there for a fundraiser, I think. And so I've spoken on that stage so many times. I know her story so well. I know her offspring.
Mm.
And I've often wondered, why haven't they got around to telling her story?
Well, the time is now.
Yeah. And you're the right person to play it, too.
Well, I hope so. I'm excited. And I think Casey Lemons is a brilliant director actress.
Yeah.
So I am thrilled that I'm going to get to work with her.
Yeah.
You know, it's a strange time. And I think people have to chart their course.
Yeah.
You have to determine how you want to be a part of the solution. And for me, it's about putting positive images out there. I have a film coming out and people are going to have problems with it because I shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Some people will think that it is me playing some type of mammy. I've never played a mammy, and I won't play a mammy.
Right.
I have a problem with that.
Yeah.
What I do play is a best friend to, the movie's called Gifted, and I play a best friend to Chris Evans's character, and he basically inherits a daughter, a niece, that he has to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I had a wonderful extended family. And the reason why I chose to do that movie was because of the fact that it's an unconventional family.
Yeah.
I am pretty much a godmother to one of my dearest friends, her young Latin boys.
Mm-hmm.
I have an affront to people who, whenever they see a black woman having anything to do with child rearing, they call her mammy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm nobody's mammy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nobody's mad.
Well, that's on the record already, and the movie ain't came out yet.
Yeah.
So
I'm just telling you, I'm getting ready. And there are people that are upset that I'm playing God. It's like, it's just so funny, the things
How can I be mad at you playing God?
I know, Morgan Freeman played God, and there was
George Burns played God.
And there was no uproar.
Everybody's played God.
Okay, but now that I'm playing God, you know, people are, you know, they're feeling a certain way about it. But you know what? I can only do what I do, and that's just be positive and try to put good work out there.
I tell you what I celebrate. What I celebrate is that you have succeeded to the point now where you have choices.
Yes.
And that you get to choose what you want to do.
Yes.
Which is so rare in this business.
It is very rare.
And what I especially love is that you're choosing to play roles like Dorothy Vaughn in Hidden Figures. That just tells a story about, and you know what I love about this? Two things. I'm out of time, but I just got, since you're here, I got to tell you this. What I love sitting in that movie was that here was a film about our people that showed characters that were complex, that were textured, that were layered. And I was just so into that, number one. Number two, obviously, they're characters that are not conventional.
Yes.
Not what you think of when you think of black women, which I think was a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing I love the most, of course, is that it is a story that shows the role that black folk have played in weaving the narrative that is America.
Yes.
I think all the time about that Du Bois quote, who Du Bois once asked, would America have been America without her Negro people?
It would have been a different America.
The country just wouldn't be.
It wouldn't be.
Without the contributions.
I agree. And here's the thing. We have always been what you see in Dorothy, Catherine, and Mary.
Yeah.
We've always been those people. It's just never been displayed on screen. And that's what I'm excited about, that people are now seeing that.
It's called Hidden Figures. It is a powerful, powerful story that you must see.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Michael T. Williamson is best known for his role as Bubba Blue in the movie Forrest Gump. The talented actor, whose many credits include the ABC series Designated Survivor, now stars opposite Denzel Washington and Viola Davis in the film adaptation of August Wilson's play, Fences. Before we talk to Michael T., here's a clip from the film.
Hey, the choice, boy.
How you doing, Uncle Gabe?
Lion! Ah. The king of the jungle. Rose, hey, Rose, I got a flower for you. I picked it myself. That's the same Rose like you is.
Oh, that's right. Nice of you, Gabe.
What you been doing, Uncle Gabe?
Oh, I've been chasing hellhounds and waiting for the time to tell St. Peter to open the gates.
I'm just me, and I don't have an Academy vote.
Okay.
But if I had one, as I've said to every friend I know, you'd get mine on it. It's over with. Man, you killed this role.
Thank you so
much. And I know you played it on Broadway, but what you brought to this role in film was just amazing to me. How did you know, or what made you believe that you could take this character from the stage and make it work on film?
Confidence in August Wilson.
Yeah.
August Wilson is, in my opinion, the most prolific American playwright. Not to take anything away from Tennessee Williams or any of the others, or Shakespeare, even for that matter, on a global front. But to mention August Wilson's name in concert with Shakespeare or Tennessee Williams and on, it's a compliment to all those men.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's to, you know, to take nothing away. But the confidence in that material,
yeah,
that it would translate, if you tell the truth with it, it worked on Broadway when we did it on Broadway, and it worked in cinema when we used the cinematic application of it.
Yeah.
But the truth is the truth.
What did you learn? And I'm making the assumption here that you did. I could be wrong. If I am, I'll back up. What did you learn about August Wilson, about his writing, about his work? What did you learn about August Wilson that with all the performances you've done of this on stage, it took you doing it on film to see, to feel, to realize? Was there something?
Absolutely.
Okay.
On stage, I thought I understood the material completely,
yeah. Yeah.
But in cinema, I realized I didn't. I did not understand how much those words meant, that journey of the two brothers. And on stage, I didn't realize that Gabriel was also Troy's caretaker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Troy wouldn't be who he is or have what he has without Gabriel's contribution. And that did not land on me as profoundly as it did on stage as it did when we shot the film.
Yeah.
It's important. Intimacy gives you, it elevates creativity.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to yell, scream, use technique. I just whisper to you what I feel and you feel it because it's intimate. And so that's what we learned, is that there's a much more powerful example of these words in cinema than on the boards or in theater.
Yeah. I wished watching this film, I've been fortunate given what I do to have been invited over the years by a lot of friends like you and others, right, to come visit the set,
right,
when something is being shot. I wish that I'd been there a couple days when y'all were filming this thing.
Right.
But for those of us who just get completely wrecked in the theater watching this emotionally, were there ever those kind of emotional outbursts or emotional moments in the filming of this?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you tell me something?
Sure.
Yeah.
I've been a fan of Denzel's for a very long time.
Right.
I've been a fan of Viola's for a very long time. Viola and I have worked together before. Denzel and I have not. But one of the things that I learned about Denzel is that the more you trust, the more that gives another person freedom. I didn't realize that until people asked Denzel, what did you do to direct and get these performances? He trusted us, completely trusted us. And I was embarrassed or ashamed not to bring my best work because Denzel completely trusted us. And that's one of the methods to his madness, to his magic, is to completely trust us. So I learned to trust on a much higher open level, because it elevated my work as well.
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of actors over the years who have talked about their own process, their own methodology for how they inhabit a particular character.
Right.
I've talked to actors who, when they
take on a character, take on the persona, they will stay in that character all day long. Even when they're not on set filming, they are Gabriel. They don't come out. Tell me about your process, how you inhabit a character like that. You go in, you go out, you stay there every day, you stay there for the entire film. What's Michael T's process?
Well, my process is all my characters are born from prayer. Mm-hmm. They're all the result of prayer, every single
Is it true that y'all start every day filming with prayer?
With prayer, absolutely.
Yeah.
Denzel has a prayer circle every single day.
Yeah.
And so that is part of his process. But for me, shame. People say, how do you go into character and stay in there? Because I can be cordial on a set and talk and laugh, but when it's time to go to work, when I go into character, I completely escape and forget where I am. I'm mm-hmm. in that character's world. And a lot of that comes from shame because of my own childhood, being molested as a kid, being ashamed of who I was, being abandoned by my father. Other kids had fathers. So I wanted to be anybody but who I was. And that has actually fed my gift as an actor, because I can disappear into a character completely and I'm gone, and my wife will go, honey, and I'm gone. I'm all the way there. And my kids, they get it. But if their friends are over, I won't rehearse. Mm-hmm. I won't practice or anything if other people are in the house, because I go, I'm gone.
What do you make of the fact, I hear you, this intimacy is working, because I hear you and I feel you. And the moment you said that about the shame,
yes, sir,
I thought of Richard Pryor, who may very well be the freest black man that ever lived. Pryor was just that free. But if you know his backstory and the prostitution and the way he grew up in the house in Joliet, Illinois, Joliet, if you prefer.
Joliet, yes.
Mm-hmm. But you know Pryor's backstory, you understand a bit more how he came to be the artistic, the comedic genius that he was. So here you come now with this confession that it is the shame that allows you to so brilliantly inhabit these particular characters. What do you make of that linkage, that it was that the giftedness, the brilliance that we see come out of you artistically is born of a place of hurt and pain and shame? How do you link those things?
Well, I don't make a good victim. Yeah. So I'm no longer ashamed of my past, but I realize how God used that. They said, your test will become your testimony. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what happened, is that the things that I've been through in my life, I'm no longer ashamed of, because I don't make a good victim. I don't have a victim mindset. I realize what happened, and I'm okay, and I'm cool. I celebrate what I've been through, because it has made me a very wealthy, conscious, kind, considerate human being.
Yeah. I don't know what, thank you for being so honest about that. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
I don't know how you process this, so let me just ask it. I don't know how you process it, so I don't know whether or not you have expectations of this industry or of this business. But when you are in a film that is as big as Forrest Gump.
Yes, sir.
And you're playing such a major character, and everybody loves that character, Bubba Blue.
Right.
And then they spin off restaurants.
Right.
Called Bubba Gump Shrimp House. And all. I mean, you know, it's a huge film that had a lot of legs. And clearly, you've been a working actor for a long time.
Right.
But there are people who would expect that when you have that kind of vehicle, that it's going to transport you to the next level.
Right. As did I.
Yeah, okay.
But
okay, that's what I want to get
at. That is a great deception.
That's what I want to get at. Tell me more about that.
Well, it's a great deception. The Bubba Gump Shrimp Company, mm-hmm. that whole thing, I've actually never eaten at one of those restaurants. To me, it's a very deep area of pain in my mm-hmm. life mm-hmm. Because I thought that I would be taken care of for working so hard and elevating this material to such a place. I was the lowest paid, and all the money I made on that movie, I had to actually reinvest in a publicist so that people would know what I really looked like, because it actually injured my career, Forrest Gump. I couldn't work for a long time after that movie, because people thought that was just a guy with that lip, and all my character work went by the wayside, and I had to pay a publicist to put me in magazines so people could see what I really looked like. And, you know,
and such a handsome fellow.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. But you know, it's a great deception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel the pain. and I hear it. What was the take, other than the fact that you had to hire a publicist, that was the way you dealt with it. What was the takeaway?
Well, the takeaway is no matter what happens, you still do your very best work.
Right.
I mean, I just coined that. That's from Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
You do the absolute best work that you possibly can and represent yourself at the highest level. You know, I kept trying to figure out a way to make that work for me.
Yeah.
But that chapter never really worked for me.
Yeah.
So this is my, I've been an actor, a professional actor since I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 59 this year.
Yeah.
This is my 50th year in the game. And I love it. I love what I do. But I also realize that there's more because I want to take my platform and help people with it.
Yeah.
And I know what this business is. You know what I mean? It's a grinder. It's a meat grinder.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll chew on you a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's greater works that I want to do. There was a gentleman who was considering jumping off a freeway not long ago, and the LA Times wrote about it. I was actually running late to an appointment because I wanted to help him. And I just want to do good work, man. I want to help people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all. I just want to help somebody.
I can't say it enough. I'll close where I began. I've seen a lot of great performances this year, but I personally have not seen anybody as brilliant as Michael T. Williamson as Gabriel in Fences alongside Denzel Washington and Viola Davis.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.